Hello, and welcome to the Europe at War podcast. Hello there, welcome back. In last week's bonus episode, you heard me chatting with Scott Burry from the Beyond Barbarossa podcast. But in this week's episode, I've chosen a very different type of guest. Matthew Menica is a military historian and former serviceman in the Australian Army. Matthew is also the founder of the On the Front Tours, which is a tour guide company specialising solely in Second World War tours in and around Berlin. Matthew and I have quite a lot in common, in the sense that we're both fascinated by the Eastern Front, we both love Berlin dearly and can't get enough of its history, or when we both have long-suffering German partners who have to put up with us banging on about the Second World War all the time. One of the tours Matthew runs is a tour of the Halber Pocket. So naturally, I was curious to hear his views on the battle, and to hear why he thinks the Halber Pocket story has been so overlooked within the historiography of the Second World War, especially in the English-speaking world. We don't just focus on Halber, of course, and throughout the chat, we mention how Halber is obviously just one part of the overall Soviet campaign to capture Berlin. Which now allows me to effortlessly segue into letting you all know that the first episodes of my new series on the Battle of Berlin will be released next week. So keep an eye out for those new episodes on your podcast feeds. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy my chat with Matthew. See you next week. Hello, Matthew. Welcome to the Europe at War podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. How are you doing today?
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on. I'm doing very well. It's a lovely sunny day, so I cannot complain.
It's a lovely warm spring day in Berlin. That's good. So before we get into the questions, just to kind of set it up for my listeners, you do tours on Halber and also on the Zielor Heights and the Battle of Berlin. So the questions that I've got for you today are going to be kind of touching on all of those topics. But before we get started, just to throw it over to you, who are you? Where are you from? And perhaps where did your interest in the Second World War begin?
Yeah, sure. So, so like you said, my name is Matt. You'll probably hear from my accent that I'm not German. I'm actually originally from Australia, but I've been calling Germany and Berlin home now for the last 10 years. I moved here in 2015 with my now wife, Isabel, who I met in Australia. She was doing a work and travel. And I always kind of say that she brought me back as a souvenir. that was 10 years ago now. And when I came over to Berlin, I've always had a keen interest in the history of the Second World War. I'm ex-military. In terms of my own personal background, I served 8 years in the Australian Army. And when I left, I kind of worked in the field of sales. I was a machine gunner in the Army, and there were not many jobs for machine gunners outside of the military. So that's what I did when I moved to Germany. And then I realized that there were so many tour companies and tours that happened in Berlin, but there was no tour company specialized specifically on the history of the Second World War. And there was so much history to tell in this city outside of the sort of the standard tours that everybody does, because that's where the history is, right? Reichstag, Brandenburg Gate, Hitler's bunker, and so on, right? Everyone follows a similar kind of line through the city, and then everyone does Sachsenhausen. But you have resistance movements, you have Ravensbrück concentration camp, you have the battle for the Reichstag inside the city center, the Battle of Berlin, you have the Zielor Heights, you have the Halber Pocket. You have all this history that's kind of just sitting there dormant, waiting for someone to kind of, you know, open up this potential to visitors to Berlin to kind of show it to them. And so I started running these tours in 2019, just as a hobby, just out of sort of my own personal interest, to show people around. And so I've been doing sort of guiding World War II sites, battlefield tours, full time since 2020. So now we're now fifth year. From an academic standpoint, I'm a historian, military historian. I studied at Deakin University, where I studied primarily, my primary area of focus was the ethics of war and conflict, which is a fascinating kind of topic. we can talk about. And I wrote many papers. One of my favorite papers, which I actually wrote, was kind of on the ethical targeting of civilians during times of war, which is something
Right.
that, you know, when we talk about the Battle of Berlin and sort of the worst Second World War, civilians became a huge target, particularly by the Soviets and the Germans,
Absolutely.
As they pushed east. So it was a fascinating kind of topic there, and I was able to bring a lot of that kind of work from my university days also into what I do here in Berlin as well. And I get into a lot of really interesting conversations with people, especially when it comes to ethics of war, because, you know, we all know war is wrong, but at the same time, we know that human history is littered with stories of conflict. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, maybe as we're kind of walking into or going through a discussion today, maybe I'm sure a few ethical questions at the level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
come up.
You're already kind of inspiring me with maybe a bit of a, you know, side question that we hadn't agreed upon beforehand. I hope this doesn't throw you too much, but I'm fascinated by the idea of your analysis of the ethics of warfare and how that links to the tours that you give. I mean, the Hauber Pocket for me, and the story I've told on the podcast, is one of the most interesting things about that story is the human impact. You know, it's the human drama. It's all of the civilians that are kind of caught up in the mix. When you're giving a tour, how do you find that balance between outlining the military strategy and the timeline of events, and then maybe segueing into perhaps the personal and the impact on the civilians? How do you balance all that within a single tour?
Well, I mean, I kind of view it as kind of one in the same, right? Because warfare is inherently a very personal and human story. Yeah, okay, we can talk about machines and weaponry and the different kind of mechanisms that are involved in sort of the act of fighting. But ultimately, the soldiers on the ground are humans. And it's, you know, the soldier on, you know, one side and the other, they've both got, in some ways, very similar characteristics. They have similar wants and hopes. Neither of them really, you know, wants to be there, to speak. And, you know, if you were to put them face together, you know, in any other situation, they'd probably be really good friends. You know, but when they're sort of put in this cauldron of warfare, it brings out this ugly side of humanity. And so when I'm leading tours through Berlin, it's important for me to talk about and frame both sides of the conflict. What were the motivations of each side? What were the motivations of the Germans? What were the motivations of the Soviets? This is particularly evident, you know, and a particular interest when I bring people out to some of the concentration camps. People always want to kind of understand, you know, what were the Germans thinking? What was the motivation for doing this? How did it get there? And that's a very complicated story. And you know, the narrative that I've crafted for some of these tours helps to illuminate that in other areas. But ultimately, when we're talking about war, we are talking about a very human story. And so I always try to bring those human stories out and highlight several soldiers in certain key battles and what their experiences were during the war. And oftentimes, some of these soldiers are actually killed or a little bit expressed throughout the war as well.
You're kind of mentioning about how, you know, a lot of these soldiers would have been perhaps friends in peacetime. They were normal people who were just conscripted into the army. But also by the end of the war in Germany, that blurring between civilian and military was already becoming very, very complicated, with obviously all of the Volkssturm that were called up, or let's say dragooned into the front line by the end of 44. You have a lot of actual civilians just being given a Panzerfaust and a Volkssturm armband, and they're told to go take on a Russian tank. So I guess when you're telling these stories, that distinction between who was civilian and who was military also becomes quite blurred in some of these final battles of the war.
Well, arguably it's blurred right from the very beginning. You know, 1939, when the Germans march into Poland, we see some pretty egregious acts of terror committed against the Polish civilians. This is only exacerbated as the Germans push further east in 1941. And then you, of course, have Goebbels declaring total war, I think, about 1943.
Yeah.
You know, we're up until that point, you know, we have sort of on the German perspective, Hitler's tried to keep the civilians, particularly the women, out of the sort of the mechanisms of war, right? So if you look at England, women were in the factories as the men were being called up. But the Germans, and Hitler in particular, wanted to keep women really kind of separate from that. He didn't want the German population at home to feel the impacts of war and conflict until he ultimately declares, you know, total war in 1943, brings the civilians into it from the German perspective. Although from their offensive standpoint, you know, the Germans have been involving the civilians right from the very beginning, indiscriminate bombing, indiscriminate murders, particularly around those who are considered to be unclean, right? The Jews,
absolutely,
Roma, yeah, and Sinti, homosexuals, right? They're being targeted, they're being rounded up, they're being sent into the camps, they're being, you know, from 1942, systematically murdered in the gas chambers. So we see civilians already being heavily targeted. Right from the very beginning. As we get to the end of the war, yeah, this line between who's a civilian and who's a soldier is completely blurred, particularly on the Eastern Front. Now, the Western Front is a different beast, but given the topic of what we're talking about, you know, with the Battle of Berlin, we'll focus primarily on the Eastern Front. You know, the West was more civil in how civilians and the Allies were kind of dealing with prisoners of war and the non-combatants. The Eastern Front is completely different. Where there is just this sort of savagery of war. The Germans instigate this, as I said, in 1941 as they're pushing further east, and the Soviets, as they turn the tide of the war and they're now pushing west, they're exacting this revenge against the Germans or any perceived collaborators. And so there are no civilians, there are no non-combatants really at this stage, particularly in the minds of the Soviets as they're pushing ever so closer to Berlin. This is really evident in, obviously, the battle for the Halber Pocket, right? Because you have soldiers and civilians caught up in this encirclement. Desperate civilians are trying to escape. The Soviets are giving them absolutely zero quarter. And you know, one of the key elements for me that always highlights this is when the Americans and the Soviets link up on the Elbe River. Now, we're familiar with the footage of the Americans and the Soviets, you know, shaking hands over the bridge. But this, the footage that we actually see was all staged. The Allies or the Americans and the Soviets linked up 2 days earlier, about 5 or 6 kilometers south of where this footage is actually taking place. And the Americans begin, you know, they want to take video footage of it. They want to kind of, you know, document this moment. But the Soviets don't allow them to do this because peppered on the Soviet side of the river are all dead civilians that the Soviet artillery had been targeting. So the Americans are really shocked at the brutality of the Soviets. They want to document this and they want to kind of show the world. And the Soviets are saying, no, this can't be, this isn't where we first meet, right? We're going to have all this, you know, through the lens of a bit of politics and propaganda, and we're just not going to talk about this. You know, and when we sort of look at the brutality, both sides know what they're doing is wrong. There's no kind of blurred morality here where we kind of look at, say, the Soviets. They've, you know, come from the perspective, well, we were brutalized, so we're going to brutalize you, and this is a consequence of your actions. Sort of this sense of moral justification. They know what they're doing is wrong. They know what they're doing is unethical. And, you know, this is part of the reason why they try to cover this up, why they don't want it filmed, why they don't want to showcase the world. Because, you know, deep down inside of all of us, we know what is inherently right, inherently wrong. And, you know, the targeting of civilians is inherently wrong. And so, but when it comes to the Eastern Front, when the cameras aren't there or the world's, I suppose, not watching, there's no quarter at all given to either side. This is not just a Soviet thing or Soviet brutality. It's also a German brutality as well.
Absolutely. To maybe link it back to Halber directly, you said how part of the, or at least one of the most interesting parts about that story is that, yes, there are, I think, roughly 80,000 German troops or like Wehrmacht troops caught in the pocket, but it's the number of civilians that are far greater. I mean, I see estimates up to 150,000, maybe even more in total. So there's a huge significant civilian population there. And it's not just the locals of the towns like Halber who are already there. It's also a lot of German refugees who are coming through the area as they're fleeing the Red Army as it advanced through East Prussia and obviously Silesia and so forth. So the area is really teeming with civilians of all different types. And that really adds to the whole chaos of it. And to be fair, whenever I talk to people, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, why were the Germans fighting at this point of the war? Why did the people in the Halber Pocket not just surrender? You can understand why Wehrmacht personnel or certainly SS personnel wouldn't surrender, because to them, they might think, right, well, either I'm going to be shot outright by the Red Army, or I'll at least spend 5 years minimum in a gulag. So you can understand why they don't want to surrender. But from the civilian side of things, they also don't want to surrender, because a lot of women in particular know what's likely to come if they fall into the hands of, you know, a marauding band of Red Army soldiers. So those reasons, I think, do explain why they then go on this kind of, you know, epic breakout attempt. I mean, it's not just the breakout, it's marching all the way through, you know, through hellfire and, you know, Red Army Air Force planes and tanks and everything to get to 12th Army lines south of Bielitz, and then go all the way up to the Elbe River to then cross over Tangermünde into the American side. It's a real long journey that can only be understood if you understand the motivations of why they'd rather do that than just surrender up to the first army, Red Army troops that they came across. So, yeah, I always found that very, very fascinating when I looked at the story of the Halber Pockets.
Oh, yeah, you're 100% correct. You know, that is a massive motivating and driving factor for both the soldiers and the civilians, right? Mm-hmm. Not to surrender to the Soviets, particularly if you're SS. I mean, that's, you know, they're going to execute you right away. There's no quarter given to the SS by captured Soviets. Wehrmacht, you know, they're a little bit different, but of course your chances of survival in captivity are pretty slim to none. I mean, the Germans lose 3 million soldiers during the war; they lose the equivalent number, or a little bit less, 2 million, in Soviet captivity.
Wow!
From 1945 to 1954, when the last German soldier is finally released. So, what you're talking about here is just incredible losses, you know, which brings the total German losses to about 5 million losses for the war, half of which, or just under half of which, are lost in Soviet captivity. And it becomes a situation of, well, what do you do? Do you take your chances on the battlefield, where, yes, you might get killed, but you also might survive, or do you take your chances in Soviet captivity, where you're effectively helpless and at the mercy of the guards and the brutality of them? And for many soldiers, it was, okay, I'll take my chances on the battlefield. And, you know, in particular with Halber, part of the reasoning that Busser ultimately makes the decision to not comply with Hitler's order to try to relieve Berlin is to give his men hope that if they do make Wenck's 12th Army, that they can surrender to the Americans, right? Yeah. And so, like any fighting force, there needs to be some motivation. There needs to be some kind of hope. You know, there's a reason why the Soviets during their air campaign, they dropped leaflets over the German positions in order to get them to surrender, and their leaflet actually read, "All your hopes are destroyed."
Yes,
and so that I think is very poignant, because these soldiers on the ground, their hope is completely destroyed. They're surrounded. Berlin is clearly going to fall. You know, anybody with any kind of sense knows that the war is effectively over at this time, and, you know, well, why keep going? You know, why? What's the motivation here? And so Busser manages to motivate his troops in part by saying, look, you know, let's go west, let's link up with Wenck, let's get across the Elbe, let's surrender to the Americans, where, you know, we know we're going to be given better treatment, and we have a chance of, you know, actually getting out of here. And that, you know, in part is what drives the men forward. It's not the only factor, of course, but it's certainly a massive one, and it's a massive driving force to, you know, to get these troops into this, you know, out of this hellish cauldron.
Absolutely. Just one last question on Halber specifically before we move on to other topics. You run tours in the Halber area. You show people the Halber Pocket, the forest cemetery, so the Waldfriedhof in Halber as well. What other sites do you show them on a tour of Halber? And what still strikes you whenever you go down to the area? Maybe when you walk through the forests and you see that there are maybe still traces of the battle even 80 years later. Now, how do the tours look like when you kind of walk through the area and show your guests around?
Yeah, so Halber is actually a very it's a funny tour, because the tour actually progresses in kind of the wrong direction. And what I mean by that is that when we do tours of the CeeLo Heights or the Battle of Berlin, we kind of get a clear sense of the direction, right? The Soviets are pushing toward Berlin.
Right.
But when we're going out to Helba, we're actually driving away from Berlin, but we're actually talking more in depth about the battle as we get further away from the city. So it's a strange one to kind of wrap your head around, because we start the battle effectively on April 21st around Zossen, and then we drive out towards Helba, which is sort of the main town and where the battlefield gets its name from, which occurs on the 28th of April. So we have a week as we're away, and we're getting further away from Berlin. So
right.
It can be a strange one in terms of timeline and helping people to wrap their heads around how the battle itself really kind of unfolds. For me, like for Helba, it's one of the things that still kind of resonates with me a lot when I go out there is just the stillness of the forests. Helba has some of the most beautiful landscape.
It does.
And the forests that are out there, beautiful walks. And when you walk through, it's just sort of deathly silent, eerily silent, perhaps. And you kind of go through the forest and you think about, you know, 80, or now we're coming up to the 80th anniversary. 80 years ago, this was hell on earth, you know, for some 200,000 soldiers and civilians who were here coming through these forests. And it's remarkable because there's a lot of material that can still be found just sitting on the surface.
Right.
From the First World War battlefields of France, the earth kind of spits everything up every year. They bring up new relics, and the French farmers call it the iron harvest. And, you know, the earth kind of gives back what was buried. But with Helba, it's sort of the complete opposite, because effectively it's sat there where it has been for the last 80 years, effectively kind of untouched, because of the sheer number of material personnel who are, you know, trying to push and escape through the forest. So when we've been out there, we've actually found quite a number of eerie equipment, I suppose.
Oh,
we've
really?
Found destroyed vehicles. We've found shrapnel. Shrapnel is everywhere.
It is.
And this is what makes the Helba pocket so deadly, is the artillery. There is, of course, direct fighting. Busser and the 9th Army are fighting on the front and the rear as they're, you know, trying to escape the encirclement. But the Soviets, how they're inflicting the most of their casualties is through artillery, through air bursts and tree bursts. Konev, because of his race to Berlin, he's kind of left his rear positions somewhat weakened, and he's really got to depend his supply lines coming up the A-13. Or the road up to Zossen. And it's not until he realizes that Buster's making the escape westward that's going to potentially sever his supply lines, that he sends down further reinforcements. His idea is to kind of, you know, encircle whatever German troops are there, leave them there, have his reserve armies kind of mop them up, and use the artillery to effectively destroy as many of them as he possibly can. And so it's the artillery which is raining effectively death down from above, and there's nothing you can do against artillery. You've just pray that it just doesn't get you, you know. And that's all you could do. It just comes. It doesn't matter how skilled you are as a soldier whatever it is. It just comes down to effectively dumb luck that it doesn't hit you.
It is.
And so when the soldiers and civilians are coming through here, this artillery is raining down. That's what we find a lot of, and you can find all that on the surface. Of course, it's all rusted out, and I kind of know a little bit what you're looking for, but you'll find these rusted out heaps of metal and steel just lying on the surface. And it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And I've seen people out there who've gone out from Instagram, and even colleagues and friends of mine who've gone out there and they've found radios, they've found rifles. All manner of different things, all sitting out there on the surface. It's all, much of it's all still there. If there's plenty of YouTube videos, you'll see them, you know, going around the Battle of Berlin. Most of those people, or most of those channels, are all going around the Helba Forest there, to the south, as that's where most of this stuff is, and it's where it's easily found.
I've seen videos of people digging up Enigma machines or, you know, parts of it. Obviously Panzer Shreks, Panzer Fausts, all these different types of equipment, alongside also some personal aspects. I mean, when I went through there a couple of months ago, I was just walking through, and you're right. If you walk through certain sections of the forest, you see these, you know, deep grooves in the land, and you'll see obviously what clearly are the result of artillery fire. There'll be, you know, a deep hole in the ground. Maybe it might also be a small defensive position that was dug out by the German troops, but in most cases you can see it's the result of direct artillery fires come in and blown away a hole in the actual ground. But then we've also found, you know, parts of exploded gun barrels as well. Probably the soldiers were just spiking that as their ammunition ran out, then they drop it. So what that's really staggering to me, because I mean, I'm from the UK, and obviously you're from Australia. You know, the idea of visiting a battlefield and still finding traces of that battle 80 years on, I mean, it's a very, in a way, I wonder if it's partly because obviously it's Germany and Germany's history of the war and how they, you know, deal with that. But in Britain, we are Second World War mad, and that place would be teeming with researchers and hobby people just going around and finding it. But in Halber, it does all seem to just be left there, and it's untouched. And I've met lots of people from Brandenburg and from the local area, and they heard my podcast on the Halber Pocket, and that was the first time that they actually heard about it. So they heard about, obviously, the war and the Battle of Berlin, but the details of the Halber Pocket itself and what happened and the size of it were unknown to most of the people that I spoke to. And I wonder if that's because the pocket, or the Halber Pocket story, is really overlooked. Everyone focuses on the Battle of Berlin and the Hitler bunker, and, you know, that's what they've all watched, Downfall, right? But there are no films about the Halber Pocket. Why do you think it's overlooked?
Well, I mean, I think one, it's the Germans and the Soviets side of it, and from a Western kind of lens, it's something that we tend to overlook because we want to look at our own soldiers, right? We want to look at the British, Operation Vistula and Veritable coming over the Rhine River, right? They're some of the big moments in for Britain. Market Garden, Normandy, of course, right? These are some of the largest kind of battles that capture the focus of the masses, effectively. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that's true because of popular films. You know, look at all the movies that have been made about the Second World War. They're all on the Ardennes, they're all Market Garden, or they're all Normandy. And even on the Western Front, we see areas that are forgotten, right? The Colmar Pocket down in Alsace-Lorraine region, the Hürtgen Forest, although that's getting a little bit of attention now. But even in through the Western sphere, right, there are still forgotten battlefields. And then when we look over to the Eastern Front, this is something that, you know, is slowly coming into the mainstream now, I suppose. I think in many ways the Second World War has such an incredibly vast span of interest and people that are interested in it. The Eastern Front's kind of becoming something new for people to kind of discover about the Second World War now. And so we're seeing a more of an interest in the Eastern Front. But, you know, people, when they think about that, they know Stalingrad and the Battle of Kursk. That's like the two things that everybody knows about. And then, of course, in the end, Berlin. Yeah. Now, the Battle of the Eastern Front, one of the things that makes it difficult as well is it's because it's such a different war compared to what's going on the Western Front. This is a war of ideologies. It's a war of it's almost a war of religion in many ways. You have National Socialism fighting against Soviet communism, which fuels this brutality. And then outside of that, you've also got many other Eastern European nations who have their own complicated relationships with Russia, with the Soviet Union, with Germany, and then, of course, with each other, which also further complicates its kind of our understanding of this as well, because we have to look at like Ukraine, their understanding with Russia, Finland, their understanding, or their kind of complicated relationship with Russia, and of course Germany as well, Poland, Belarus, right? All of these nations that are mixed in, which are kind of outside of the scope of general knowledge of most people in England and America and Australia. We know the English, we know the French, to an extent we know the Italians. So this kind of makes sense to us. Absolutely. But on the Eastern Front, this is all very, very kind of new ground for a lot of us. And we tend to treat the Eastern European nations as this kind of monolith, and they're all effectively the same. So it's a very complicated history out over toward the east. That kind of complicates it as well. But to kind of bring it back to Halbur, Halbur is, again, it's kind of lost in the broader spectrum of the Battle of Berlin. When we think about the Battle of Berlin, we just only think about the city of Berlin itself. But we forget that the Battle of Berlin begins 90 kilometers outside of the city. It begins at the Seelow Heights. It begins on the Oder River. It begins south at Marnau, and where Konev is coming through. Mm-hmm. And so when we're kind of wanting to look at the Battle of Berlin, we've got to realize that this operation is enormous, right? It's one of the largest operations of the entire war. And we kind of condense it down to help ourselves comprehend it by just focusing at it purely on the city. But there are over 3 million Soviet soldiers
that are staggering
in the Battle of Berlin, right? Then you've got you have a million in air quotes here, German soldiers who were defending the city, right? So you've got just this enormous numbers that make what we look at on the Eastern Front, on a big part on the West, they just dwarfs it, right? The battle for the Seelow Heights alone has a million men involved in it, 768,000 of which are infantry.
Staggering.
Now, right, when we look at that to Normandy, the largest amphibious landing, right, which is true, the Americans or the Allies land 250,000 troops on the beaches of Normandy in the opening months of that campaign. The Seelow Heights, which is the beginning of the Battle of Berlin, is one aspect of three Soviet-Russian fronts, is four times larger in scale than the entire Normandy operation.
Yeah.
So we're talking about sort of almost incomprehensible numbers as well, which are difficult to kind of comprehend. And then Halbur, of course, is another aspect in this. And now Halbur gets further kind of lost in the weeds of this, because Halbur is viewed by everybody effectively is almost like a war crime, right? The Soviets effectively know what they're doing. They know there are civilians who are in and amongst the soldiers as well.
Yeah.
And they're indiscriminately targeting them. And so the Soviets after the war, they don't want to really talk about it. The Germans after the war, they don't really want to talk about it because, well, they're now the losers of the war, so they can't really bring it forward. And so when the war ends and things sort of settle down, you know, you're talking 10, 20 years later, there are still some East Germans who are looking at the Halbur Pocket as a point of victimization as well. The only kind of victimization that we have, or we look at the war crimes committed against the Germans, is in the Western conscious, the only one that we really have is, of course, Dresden, the bombing of Dresden by the Americans. And the Brits, but we have also the bombing of Hamburg, right? The firebombings of Hamburg,
which Operation
and then, of course, Halbur Pocket, and a few others. But there's only really one that, if you were to ask sort of your general history enthusiasts about, you know, what war crimes were committed against the Germans, almost everybody would say Dresden, and the others kind of would get kind of forgotten about.
Exactly.
And Halbur falls into this category.
But even this debate about how much do you commemorate, I saw a story a few months ago from every year, I think around Christmas, local people put candles on the gravestones within the Halbur Forest Cemetery. And for them, they're doing it maybe because it was, you know, one of their family members who died there or something. But I saw that the police came along and took a lot of those candles away, because they were concerned that this had been put there by, you know, far right elements who were trying to lionize the whole story. And so even now, 80 years later, there's still tensions there where the police are very quick to act upon anything they even perceive to be potentially, a right wing or a far right motivation around the story. So I still find that very, very interesting to contemplate.
Yeah. Oh, it certainly is. It's something that drives much of the consciousness of German politics even today.
Yeah.
Which makes it German politics fascinating, but, you know, in some ways also very frustrating.
Yeah.
And particularly if you're, you know, someone who's looked at German history quite closely, you can see some very similar mistakes being made by German politics.
Yeah.
Particularly in the 1920s, right, the Weimar Republic tried to crush the Nazis. by banning them, which was one of the, I think, probably one of the dumbest things they could have done, because it just drew more light and more attention to their cause, similarly to what modern politics tends to do as well, right? If the police just let them use the candles and let them light it there, no one would have known about it. They take it away, all of a sudden they give more attention to what it is that they're actually trying, the Streisand effect.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, but with Germany, they're hypersensitive with anything that could be potentially, even remotely, obliquely seen as right wing or in some way sympathetic to the Nazi cause. That gets shut down right away. Even their central memorial inside of the middle of Berlin, the Neue Wache, very powerful monument. It's actually probably one of my favorite. You know, it's an old way to sort of frame it, but it's one of the most moving war memorials, which is has a statue in there by Katha Kollwitz, and the statue is it's titled The Mother, and inside of the Neue Wache, which was a Prussian guardhouse built in 1813, it depicts a mother embracing her dead child who's been killed in conflict, and she's kind of frozen in this perpetual state of agony, and in the ceiling of the memorial, they've cut a hole in it, which adds to this additional level of, you know, here we are, you know, we move on, time changes, you know, the sun rises and sets, and it rains, it sun shines, it snows, time is passing, but here we have this figure, the mother, who is just stuck in this pain that she's lost her child in war. And for me, I think that's so incredibly powerful, because it shows us that these wounds suffered by individuals, you know, we can glorify war, we can look at the, you know, the generals and the top level down, that human level story, that those casualties that we talk about, which sometimes gets lost when we're talking about vast numbers. There was a quote which is oftentimes credited to Stalin, but it's disputed. One death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. You know, we can get lost in these figures. You know, we talk about the hole in the pocket. You know, it's estimated that 60,000 people were, killed and injured. The estimate is 30,000 killed, 10,000 soldiers, and then there's sort of 20,000 wounded or, you know, missing or whatever it may be. The numbers are always a little bit skewed and disputed. So we'll just go with the top end of, you know, 60,000. Like, that's an incredible amount of people. And here we have 60,000, you know, effectively mothers, as the statue of Katha Kollwitz would say, who's mourning the loss of their children somewhere. Yeah, and so for me, I find that memorial to be just so moving, because it really brings us back to what the reality of warfare is, right? It's the horribleness of man killing each other.
Absolutely.
And, so that I find that to be, worth it, which is probably the most moving one. I'm not sure if I think I lost my train of thought there.
No worries. No. It is a very, very powerful memorial, as you said. And I think, as you said, when you're down in Halber as well, and you walk through the forest cemetery, or even just through the forests, as you said, it is very, very still and very, very silent. And I think that's the best way of remembering, you know, the horror and the awfulness of what happened. It's just, it's that loss of life, and which is represented by the silence of everything. And even, from what I understand, so with the Zelo Heights, I mean, we can move on to that now, but also with Halber and the Zelo Heights, they're still finding lots of bodies every year. So I know in Halber, the German War Graves Commission did a couple of large burials in 2022 and one again in end of 2020, where they buried roughly 80 bodies each time. And that was a collection of ones that they had found, obviously, in the meantime, right? And they are still finding, you can still find human remains there. And I'm sure along the Zelo Heights, I'm sure it's even more of that. I mean, I don't know. I imagine that there are even more people there who are being found because of just the way that it's all a big floodplain. But that's staggering. You know, that's why we'll never really know how many numbers that it actually was, because, as you said, we're still finding people. And obviously, in the chaos of war, there's refugees moving through. There's people. Not everyone had their ID on them, and so we don't know who these people are. Sometimes when we find them, there's so many unknown or unmarked graves as well in Halber, because we just don't know who this body belongs to. It's staggering.
Yeah, exactly right. So I just remembered what my point was when I was talking about the Catholic Commons statute, which is becoming, I was trying to bring it back to sort of how the Germans look at the war and sort of not to idealize the Wehrmacht or, you know, even kind of, you know, try to bring out this narrative of the good Wehrmacht or the clean Wehrmacht, as it's often referred to, which of course is not true. The Wehrmacht committed plenty of crimes.
It's not true.
Yes. And so, but what I was saying with the Katakovic soldier, or the Katakovic statue, sorry, is that the Germans try to look at it through a holistic picture, right? Because it's dedicated to all the victims of war. And that's sort of what the Germans are trying to push in terms of their commemoration of the Second World War. It's not, you know, we look at, you know, the English or the Australians, we have Anzac Day. It's very focused around the soldiers and the sacrifice of the men and women who serve in uniform. The German commemorations are on everybody, you know, not just the Germans, but on those who were killed, you know, fighting. The Germans kind of see themselves being liberated from National Socialism just as much as the rest of the world as well. So their kind of force of remembrance, or their avenue of remembrance, is to look at everybody, the holistic picture, which I think has its, you know, certainly has its merits. So I just got a little bit lost on with the Catacombs soldier memorial, and then it came back to me as you were talking there.
No worries, it's all very good. I wanted to
answer your question around Sea Level Heights. They're finding things all the time. They're finding unexploded ordnance out there all the time. It's just incredible what's out there. And it's the Soviets as well. You know, we look at the Germans quite a lot, but the Soviet soldiers, they suffered horrendously at the hands of their own commanders. When we're looking at Soviet losses throughout the Second World War, I mean, we're talking about just cataclysmic figures, you know, like entire small nations worth of dead.
Incredible.
And for the Soviets, they only recorded the deaths of those who were members of the Communist Party. Just before the Battle of Berlin actually takes place, the Communist Party sees its largest application swell for membership, because these soldiers, you know, want to have their families notified if they fall, or have their names recorded if they're killed.
Oh, wow.
And so when we're looking at Soviet casualties, the official Soviet casualties, we've always got to take with a grain of salt, but we know at a very minimum that when they are declaring their casualties, these are just party members. These are just members of the Communist Party.
Right.
They never recorded any figures for the Polish who were killed, of which 80,000 were fighting on the Sea Level Heights. The numbers that we have around Polish casualties are only ever estimates, because we can never get a precise figure. The Polish tried to do the best they could, but of course you need to, there's a paper trail, right? We're not talking about, you know, modern methods for recording data, right, where everything is kind of saved to a cloud. You know, 1945, it's all physical paper, and it's all through the memory of witnesses. You know, when after the war is over, people go back, oh, did you see person X? Oh yeah, I did. He went into a building. I never saw him again. Okay, well, how do you know what happened
to him?
You know what happened to him, right? Is he so, you know? And so a lot of it relies on this kind of eyewitness. Oh yeah, I think I saw him, he went over there or whatever. You know, there's people that are missing and all this,
right.
And so and the Soviets didn't make any effort to try to, you know, clarify their numbers or to do any further research or anything like this. So they just kind of say, well, you know, if you killed, there's a reason why Soviets, you know, they have sort of mass graves. You know, part of their communist ethos is everybody is the same, right? So there's no kind of special treatment given to those who were alive, and, you know, the comrades and those who were killed, everybody is all one. So the numbers of bodies that are being found out at Silo and Halber and everywhere else is, you know, again, vast, but what we're not recording. So we know the German War Grave Cemetery, they had a campaign last year called A Million for a Million, where they wanted to raise €1 million to recover a million war dead over in Eastern Europe.
Okay.
And that's sort of because they've recovered a million people since the end of 1945. So it wasn't like they just recovered a million since, you know, the end of, you know, the last year, but they were wanting to recover that million. They needed an extra €1 million to bring them all sort of across. Now, they actually did achieve their funding efforts, and they did achieve the goal of repatriating 1 million German soldiers who were buried over in the east. and you know, field cemeteries and the likes as well. But we don't have an equivalent service for this for the Russians, right? Because the Soviet Union, of course, no longer exists. The Soviet Union is made up of many different countries, and so we don't even really know the figures of what Russia is repatriating, if they're really redoing it at all. You know, there are some charity efforts and sort of individual efforts to go out there and recover war dead, but there's no commission style like the Commonwealth War Grave or the German War Grave Commission that's going out there. And it's a similar story for the soldiers of the Eastern Front who fought for the Germans. In fact, they're just forgotten about really at all. And the German War Grave Commission, I know, does make some effort to recognize some of those soldiers, whether they be Finns, Poles, Czech, Hungarians, whatever it may be. But these countries in the East, they don't want to draw attention to those soldiers.
They're not doing any effort. No, it's a source of shame.
No,
they don't want
to. No, it is. Yeah. It's a source of shame. And whenever they do get found, they're very quickly buried. And these numbers are certainly not something that they publicize.
Not recorded.
Bury them deep in the bureaucracy.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. That's incredible. I didn't know that. I didn't know that that there was no organized effort from modern day Russia to actually still try and look for and repatriate, as you said, the what would have been many hundreds of thousands, if not more, of Red Army soldiers that are surely buried and still there to be found. But no one's really doing it. That's incredible. I want to bring it on to, obviously, we're coming up now. It's April 2025 right now, as I talked to you, but that's the 80th anniversary of April 1945. What are your plans with your tours coming up now over the next few months? I can imagine there is a large interest in kind of piecing together the Zelor Heights battle and then the Battle of Berlin itself and then Halber. Are you kind of weaving together a unified tour that touches upon all of those points and making a kind of very grand narrative of everything that was going on?
Yes, we are. So in June, we have a Battle of Berlin 3-day tour where we begin at the Zelor Heights, and then we follow that narrative into the outskirts of Berlin, but we could have cut that off. And then the next day, we go out to the Halber Pocket. We cover the narrative of the Battle of the Halber and the escape and the what occurred there. And then we have the final day, which is inside of Berlin itself, inside of the Citadel, or Sector Z, as it was. And we trace the Soviet military through the Alsterstrasse, down over the Molka Bridge, across to the Königsplatz, and ultimately capturing the Reichstag itself. So this 3-day tour is designed to cover the, as best we can in 3 days, but the full scope, if you will, of the Battle of Berlin, Zelor, Halber, and then Berlin itself. So that's taking place at the end of June. We weren't able to, our initial thinking was we'll do it sort of in the same timeline as the Battle of Berlin itself, but because there's a number of 80th year anniversary celebrations and different things going on, commemorations is probably more accurate.
Yeah.
A lot of these memorials are closed or they've got events going on. So we weren't able to kind of, you know, guarantee that we could get access to most of these sites. So we're doing it now in June.
Right.
So we're well past kind of what is the commemoration sort of portion of the 80th anniversary. And it'll give us a chance to explore the area fully without kind of worrying about if things will be open or closed. So that's on the 27th, of June. We still have a couple of seats available on that.
Very good.
I can't remember how many we have. I think it was 7, I think we have left, or maybe a few more coming up now. So that's selling out pretty quick. And then we also have sort of our usual daily tours, which we run out there. We run tours to the Zelor Heights twice a week. Halber Pocket, we only run that on a private basis because there's just not enough interest, as we've kind of touched on here, to run a weekly tour out there, unfortunately. But we do go out there to Halber usually once or twice per month, when we bring out groups, history enthusiasts, militaries, students, universities. We take them out there to look at this history as well. So,
okay.
Yeah, we do. In total, we have 12 tours.
Okay.
Just to kind of give myself a little bit of a plug here, maybe.
No worries.
Each of the tours are, well, they're broken down into four categories. First is the Third Reich, where we look at sort of our general Third Reich tour, where we look at the rise of the Nazi Party, we look at the resistance movements. And then we have a hidden World War II, where we look at some of the more obscure sites. And we have a area focused on the Holocaust and the concentration camps. So we go to Sachsenhausen, Ravensbrück. And then we have a tour which I'm particularly proud of that we put together called The Final Solution, where we look at the mechanisms and the bureaucracy behind The Final Solution and how these decisions were made. And we go to the buildings where the former institutions of racial hygiene, T4, where all these buildings and headquarters once were that made these decisions that ultimately lead to the mass murder of 11 million people from 1939 to 1945, ending at the Wannsee Conference, which of course is where the Final Solution ultimately is decided. We then have our battlefield selection tours, which is Silo Heights, Halber Pocket, and then the Battle of Berlin itself, which is focused around the Reichstag. And then we have a selection of Cold War tours as well, which kind of look at the aftermath of the war, the Berlin Wall. Yeah. We do a mixed Second World War and Cold War tour. And then we have tours out to the Potsdam, which covers sort of the full plethora of German
history.
To the Cold War. So that's a really fascinating tour as well, especially if you want to learn all about Germany in one day.
Yeah, I can imagine. I studied in Potsdam. So my master's in international politics is from Potsdam University. So I'm a big Potsdam fan.
Oh, wow.
I lived there for a couple of years. And I lived very close to what was, well, it's still Glinica-Brücke, but obviously it was the, you know, spy exchange bridge. So Gliebnitzsee was the area I lived in. So I think one thing that you've just kind of inspired me to kind of add as a comment, so all of those tours that you offer, it's just once again proof that this area, so Berlin, is really, it is teeming with history. I mean, I'm researching and now about to publish my Battle of Berlin series, and I knew about the Battle of Berlin. I mean, I've also lived in Berlin for more than 15 years, so I knew most of the locations. But when you do your research, and then you go and look for, you know, Spang or just, you know, like bullet tracer fire or things that are still visible on some buildings, it still shocks me and still surprises me what is in my area. I mean, I live up here in Wedding. So I've got the Humboldt Hein Flak Tower, which is just around the corner. Also down the road, I've got the brewery where Moncker's breakout group after the Battle of Berlin was coming to an end, the breakout group eventually reached up at that brewery and had to then surrender. That's also very, very close to me as well. I could walk there within 5-10 minutes. It's really staggering what is in Berlin to see. It's just the history. I know it sounds a bit glib and a bit maybe sensational, but history really is on every corner here in this city. And I still really find that very exciting.
Yeah, it's one of the best parts about living in Berlin, I have to admit. Like, it's literally, it's on every corner. Every bullet mark, every trace of it tells a story there. And because Berlin, so there's like, for me, there's three cities in Germany that are the most important to kind of visit in terms of understanding the history of the Third Reich. There's Munich, Nuremberg, and Berlin. Mm-hmm. And they've got to kind of be visited in that order to get sort of the full, you know, breadth of it. You know, Munich being the birthplace of the movement, as Hitler called it, Nuremberg being the spiritual home of the movement, and Berlin being the capital of the movement. And so all of the institutions are, of course, present in Berlin. And then you, of course, have the battle, which is incredibly fierce. And then you have the immediate aftermath of the war, right? Going to Potsdam, you have Cecilienhof, you have the Potsdam Conference. This lays the foundation for the Cold War. And the geopolitics, which we're experiencing now, how borders are divided and what the tensions are, the relationship between different nations. All of this was decided in Berlin, and it's all we're living through this, you know, the consequences and the aftermath of this history as well. Yeah. And Berlin is such a fascinating city in this because it's a city that's unlike any other in Germany. There's a, you know, there's a saying amongst Berliners that if you come to Germany and you want to be in Berlin, you haven't been to Germany. You've just been to Berlin because it's sort of, you know, this is sort of international world kind of city in some ways. And so much of how we understand Europe and how we understand our modern era, it's all been decided here in Berlin, and it's all been decided and linked back to the Second World War and the aftermath of this tumultuous history. So, Berlin is a magnificent city, and I'm always discovering new things. You know, there's people often ask me on my tours. They say, "Well, you know, do you get sick of going through and showing people the same things and doing the same thing?" And I said, "Well, it's never the same thing because there's always something new to uncover. There's always a new aspect to uncover, and every group that I take through the city, everybody has their own different perspectives and viewpoints of the war. Everybody has their own questions, things they want to get out of each of the tours. So every time I bring a group down and show them through Berlin, I'm almost uncovering new aspects of the city kind of with them as we're molding through our discussions and we're having our own, talks through the area that we're walking through. So it's just a fascinating, and I'm very privileged and very thankful to have the job that I do, because I wake up most mornings and look forward to going out and meeting people and taking them around the city. So it's quite a bizarre, it's a weird thing, because it's such a horrible history in some ways, but it's so fascinating to see how it still impacts us.
And, I think, like you said, you don't understand the modern day story without understanding what happened at the end of the Second World War. You know, the Second World War shaped the 20th century, and we're still living in many ways the impact of, the borders that were drawn up at the end of the war still play a huge role in modern day European politics and everything that we go through now. So it's certainly a very important history that I hope, or I really wish more people knew about, because it's just so important to understand if you want to know where we're at today.
And that also brings me to another point, actually, when it comes to sort of the end of the war, right? The question that I get a lot is, well, why would the Germans keep fighting? Why did they keep doing it? We spoke before about the hope for the Ninth Army getting across to the Americans, but what about those who were in Berlin? There's a really good book which I always recommend people to read, which is by a man called Tony Letizia, and it's called Our Backs to Berlin. It's a fascinating book, and it's a series of soldier collections and testimonies after the war.
Right.
And one of the things that I love about this book is just the indifference of many of the soldiers who were fighting. It was this sense of duty. It wasn't ideological, right, as what you would expect sort of perhaps at the top among sort of Hitler's inner circle, right? We see a fanaticism there to keep going. For the average man on the ground, it's this sense of, well, I'm here now. I can't do anything about my situation. I can't run away. I can't do anything about that. And then there's the man next to me who's, he's in the same boat that I am. So I've got to fight. I've got to try to, stand alongside my my comrade. But then on top of that, you have the system, the Gestapo, the military police, who are also bringing the system of violence with this as well, by having roving court-martials and publicly executing soldiers and civilians for fleeing the battlefield, hanging them from street lamps and signs with placards draped over their necks, calling them cowards and traitors for not believing in the final German victory. Exactly. And so there's this, well, why keep going? Why do it? And so, well, really, you've got no choice. The man next to you, you may only know him a couple of hours, or you may have known him, last few months or even years. But there's a sense of duty that the soldiers feel to the man next to them. And there's also a sense of, overarching dread and fear that if they don't do what they're told, they don't keep going forwards, then they'll end up strung up to a street lamp and tarred a coward.
It's not much of a choice if your choices are death from a Gestapo bullet, or it's death from a Soviet work camp, in Gulag. So it or just death from a Red Army soldier. So it's really it's not much of a choice there at all.
No, it's no choice at all.
No. Perfect. Then thank you very much, Matthew. I think that was a really, really fantastic chat. I know we went from left to right, up to down on all different deviations, but I really love these chats where we can just flow and, deviate as and bounce off each other as the topics come. So it's been a really, really fantastic chat. Thank you again so much for your time. If people want to come and find you, find your tours, where should they look for you?
So On the Front Tours is the name of my company, and they can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We have all those social medias. So people are interested in coming down. The website is the best. They can email me directly and we can put together customized tours and different things for them. But if they go onto the website, that's kind of our main traffic driver. So everything is available on there. So hopefully if anyone's listening to this and they want to learn more about Berlin and come out and see these areas, I'd be very happy to hear from them.
Perfect. Then that, thank you so much, Matthew. I'll make sure all of that gets posted. And yeah, once again, thank you very much for our chat and for talking to my audience today. I think we're done for now. So just to wish you lovely rest of your day and we'll be talking again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, David.
Take care.